meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely pursuant to Rule 10.01. I have been notified that we have a quorum, but we're going to go ahead with the roll. Anna, if you could go ahead with taking the roll, please.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott. Representative Feitz.
Sorry, present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grosser.
Present.
Representative Herr. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vane.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Scott. And Representative Herr.
Representative Herr, I don't think we could hear your audio, but I can see that you're here. and with that, we'll get started. Today we have two presentations. First, we'll have a group of district court judges will be joining us to talk about the work that they do. And then we will have a brief presentation from Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid related to the eviction court process. So I'm not sure, we have a whole crew of judges here this morning, so I'm not sure who's going first, but if you want to get started, please do introduce yourself for the record and the organization that you're with. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Hoffman. I'm a trial court judge in Washington County, Minnesota. I'm the president of the Minnesota District Judges Association, which we'll refer to as MDJA. Previous to this, I have been the chief judge of the 10th Judicial District, which is comprised of eight counties that start in Pine County and work across northern tier of the suburbs out to Buffalo, Minnesota, and Wright County. There's 45 judges in the 10th Judicial District. We have suburban, urban courthouses plus rural courthouses in Pine and Kennebec. I'm going to give you some history of the MDJA. The MDJA, you can think of as the professional organization like of medical doctors, but it's for judges. The vast majority of the trial court bench belongs to the MDJA. That consists of about 295 trial court judges. Our membership does include both the appellate courts, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court, and we believe we have a fair majority of judges that also belong in the appellate courts to the MDJA. Our organization is represented by a lobbyist who is Nancy Haas, which many of you might know. She's a lawyer with Messerly and Kramer, and she has represented our organization for at least 15 legislative sessions. Prior to her, her partner, Sandy Nieren, represented our organization, and our organization has been represented by for many years by the Messerly and Kramer firm, and we appreciate her representation because in the end, she is our connection to the legislative process, and we appreciate the fact she was able to get us this meeting with the House Judiciary Committee. If any of you have questions during my presentation, you're free to break in and ask those questions because I'm more interested in what you want to know from us. I'm going to give you some background information about what has been going on with the MDJA. So during this legislative session, we have had three legislative priorities, and they're pretty simple. One is the pandemic caseload relief that we need. You know, all cases start in the trial courts. And so we're the ground force that takes care of anything that happens in the trial courts. And you've probably been made aware of what's happened with the pandemic. We've had to completely change the way that we do business. None of us ever thought a year ago that we would only be holding court hearings via this kind of mechanism, electronic Zoom type of a mechanism. Did you have a question? Oh, I didn't know if you were raising your hand to ask a question. So we have had to restructure our entire way of doing business, and that has been accomplished by the worthy efforts of SCAO staff, which is Supreme Court Administrative Staff, and our staff at the trial court level, and trial court judges who have had to figure out how to navigate electronic court proceedings. So that is one thing that we have asked for relief, and our relief has been in the form of engaging our retired colleagues to help us with this pandemic workload. And we have gotten a lot of support by the Judicial Council to make sure that our colleagues as retired judges can assist us in this effort to break down this backload. And the second area of our concern is our pension stability. We have long been present in the legislature through Meserly and Kramer about our pension and its stability, and we're very concerned about that. You're going to hear a little bit more about that from Judge Jasper, who is the chair of our pension committee. And then the third issue is judicial compensation. Now, we are not tone deaf to the fact that there's an economic crisis that accompanies this pandemic. But we want to simply educate the legislature and make you aware of compensation concerns that we have. And I know we're not going to talk about that today, but that is one of our issues. You should understand that we are on the same page with the Judicial Council this year in the legislative session. And we have not always been on the same page as the Judicial Council. So it is a unified request about compensation issues. So those are our highlights for our concerns as the trial court bench. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what a judge does, and it might be easy now to have you invited into our court hearings via Zoom, because it's simply an electronic invitation and a link. So that has made us more accessible to people like you that are busy, and we want you to know what we do on a day-to-day basis. In the pandemic, you can see maybe in the background, I'm in my chambers in Washington County. I typically work from my chambers. There's 10 judges in Washington County. There's about three of us that regularly come in and do our work at our chambers. I do it because I have all my resources at my disposal in my chambers, and it's quiet here, and I can do my work more reasonably, in my view. Other judges have chosen to work at home. You're going to hear from Judge Jasper, who has not been in the Anoka County Courthouse since the pandemic began. But one of the ramifications of this new way of doing work is I have two confidential employees. They're critical to the functioning of a trial court judge, in my view. And I have not seen my court reporter since March. I have not physically laid eyes on my court reporter since March, when everything started closing down. Now, she attends all of our Zoom hearings. She does a wonderful job. And the record-keeping part of the work of a court reporter has gone on pretty seamlessly. And I have a court reporter. I rarely see my court reporter. We have to contact each other electronically and by email and by phone. And you can imagine that your staff members that work closely with you, how potentially disabling it is not to have your confidential staff working with you on a day-to-day basis and being able to communicate directly with you. So that has been a big change. You know, this job of being a trial court judge, you might appreciate, is a isolating job, but it has become much more isolating as we've been taken away from the people that we work with on a regular basis. So we're a bunch of kind of satellites out here just trying to do the work of the court, and And it has been difficult on the trial court bench. It has also been difficult on the staff of the court administrators that have to manage and move people in and out of the court system so they can have their hearings accomplished. And Zoom is great. It's a wonderful invention. It's allowed a lot of people that are poor and unable to travel because of transportation problems or other infirmities in their life to get to court more readily. But you should understand that probably doing cases by Zoom is not as efficient as having people in a courtroom with you. Number one, I estimate as a trial court judge that I'm maybe about 50% as effective as I am when I have live people in courtrooms that can respond immediately to inquiry, can be identified immediately. We spend inordinate amounts of time trying to identify people on Zoom because, you know, people call in like you did today. You all have your names on your call-in information. Many people that call into our courts, we have to take time to identify, and sometimes the technology isn't as great. You know, we are afforded great access to technology and bandwidth in the court systems, but the people that are trying to use our court systems are not. They struggle with bandwidth. A lot of them are in cars and are trying to find hotspots where they can get access to the internet, and they're worried that because they're not on a video visually, that's a problem. It's important that we hear them. It's very nice if we can see them, but some people just don't have those capabilities. So I worry a little bit about how justice is perceived to be dispensed on this medium. I do think that it's preferable, obviously, that we see each other and talk to each other directly. So that's kind of the life of a judge. We're hoping that in this process, if you've not been exposed to the judiciary, that you will ask us questions about that. We're happy, all of us are happy, if you have more interest in it to hitch you up with a judge in the district in which you represent, whether it's Hennepin or Ramsey or Southern Minnesota or Northwestern Minnesota, we can do that. We can make you get connected with a trial court judge, and you can actually see what we do every day. You don't have to spend 2 hours doing it, but maybe 40 minutes doing it is helpful and insightful. So that's what we hope to do. So with that, I intend to pause and wonder if any of the members of your committee or the chair might have any questions.
Thank you, Judge Hoffman. And just as far as time management, are any of the other judges planning to give any kind of presentation?
Right. We have a whole way we're going to present to you. My little part of it is now done, but we're going to talk to Judge Jasper next, and he's going to talk about pensions and benefits.
Okay. We'll take two questions from members right now. Okay. But I'll just remind you, you know, mostly what we want to hear today is about how the court system works, you know, as far as any of the legislative requests that the judges will be making. You know, you'll have an opportunity to testify on that when those bills move forward and when we're talking about budget issues. So first, I'm going to go to Representative Robbins.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge Hoffman and the other judges for being here today. I first of all want to say I did shadow a district court judge in my first term, and it was a very enlightening experience. So I highly recommend it to all my colleagues. But seeing you guys in action and seeing how quickly cases move and how people just walk in, see their, especially when we're dealing with public defenders, they just meet for the first time, they confer for a couple minutes, then you're moving and it goes on to the next one. It's very quick. So I just wondered, how does that happen in a Zoom environment? And then secondly, you alluded to how sometimes it's hard to verify people's identities,
right?
Especially if you can't see them. So could you talk about how you know the person is sure. who they say they are, and that it's, especially if there's no visual or no right. way to verify, how do you know you're dealing with the right person? Thank you.
Yeah. Judge Hoffman.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for the question. So in terms of Zoom, we have our staff, meaning my reporter and a court administrative staff, can put people in breakout rooms. And I think we have up to like 5 breakout rooms. So when an attorney says, you know, judge, this is the first time I've ever even seen my client. I've not been able to get in contact with them. We can put them privately in a breakout room and they can talk. And then I go on to other cases in my calendar. The people that call in and they're unidentified, you know, like Galaxy Phone 3S, they may not have bandwidth, for example, to get on video and audio. So we will tell them, if we cannot hear you because of your bandwidth issues, please call in. And when they call in, because I've never seen them and maybe their attorney has never seen them, the only thing I do is I ask them, what's your date of birth? They should know their date of birth because I know their date of birth because of the calendar I have, and what you're charged with. And if they can give me those answers, I'm satisfied that I think the person I'm talking to is the person that's supposed to be appearing in court.
Representative Robbins, any follow-up?
Just one, Madam Chair. So thank you for that answer, Judge Hoffman. I have to say that's kind of stunning because a lot of people would know the birth date and the charge if they're from their circle. So is there no other way to ascertain their identity? I'm just kind of stunned by it. Thank you.
Well,
Judge Hoffman.
No, thank you. There's not really in a live courtroom, you know, you can figure out who people are. And but with attorneys, I will ask them, have you talked to this person on the phone? Yes, I have. Do you recognize the person who's talking to me as the person you talked to on the phone? Yeah, I just text and talk to them before the hearing, judge. I am certain that the person you're talking to is the defendant you're supposed to be dealing with. That's the best we can do.
Thank you, Judge Hoffman. And I know as a former court clerk that, you know, that's really you're all basing things on people's word and, you know, those kinds of information, whether it's in real life as well. It's not like you know the people on your calendar ahead of time a lot of the time. The next question is from Representative Johnson.
Chair, I just two quick things. First of all, just to let you know, Representative Peggy Scott had some computer issues. She's now here, so if you get that in the actual rolls, I would appreciate that. But I have a question for Judge Hoffman. First of all, I want to thank you for what you do. I've spent my career in law enforcement in the 10th Judicial District, and I've heard some very good things about you. Although I don't believe I had any cases before you, which is might be a good thing. Mm. But I always look for positives out of every situation. And for the past year, we've had a bad situation, but I think we can pull some positives out of it. With the new technology and the backlog that we're going to have in the court systems, I'm just wondering if how it would work with this new technology, with some of the pretrial and some of the procedural court cases where a person has to show up at the courthouse, wait 4 hours for his court case to go before the judge for 2 minutes, and then they're released. Have you looked at, once this is over, putting some of those procedures in where we can actually free up a lot of court space, court time, and a lot of issues where people aren't spending the entire day for a 3-minute hearing? I've also had issues where, as a deputy, I've had to travel 6 hours to pick a person up to bring them to the courtroom for a 2-minute court appearance, and then somebody else to drive them 6 hours back to where they were. Yeah. Some of this, I think with the technology we're getting, we can actually save the state money, save court time, and also get quite a few more things done in the long run. I'm just wondering your opinion on that.
Judge Hoffman.
Thank you. I think there's called the Other Side Work Group that has been established by the Judicial Council. And they are looking into, there's a whole committee that reports to the Chief Justice and ultimately the Judicial Council about what we learned from the pandemic and what we can do better. And I know that there are considerations about maybe changing routine hearings, arraignments, pre-trials into actual Zoom hearings so that people don't have to travel. I can tell you that I've had a lot of experience dealing with people in custody, and they've been up in Cass County, they've been in Hennepin County, they've been in Ramsey County, they've been in Dakota County, which obviously saves the transportation issues and the security issues that might be faced with deputies or transport people from the sheriff's office, bringing people around the metro area or across the state to make hearings. There is some efficiencies that can be drawn in maybe routine mental health cases, where people are at state hospitals or other facilities and they can't get transported. They're at the St. Peter or there are other places. But in that area, you know, you have people that have mental health issues to begin with. And they may be actually suspicious of the fact that how do they know they're talking to a trial court judge? They may question that. So that might not be the best use of that resource, but it is being investigated. And people that are poor and have transportation challenge that might be able to appear on a first appearance on a misdemeanor, for example, via Zoom, I think that is being explored. And we understand there are efficiencies that can be drawn. My ultimate concern, however, is that the court system is a person-to-person experience, in my view. And I think there is an overarching question of if you cheapen the way that justice is administered to people and what they feel about how justice is administered to them. I get sitting for 20 minutes to get arraigned, but you have to understand if we have a whole arraignment calendar of Zoom people, they're going to be waiting 20 minutes to get arraigned too, because the Zoom experience does not go as quickly as an in-person court experience, or it might be equal. So I'm not sure that that might save energy or efficiency, but I think it's being explored.
Thank you, Judge Hoffman. Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Judge Hoffman, I want to thank you for that. I can see that side of it as well, but just so you know, I'm a firm believer that the final court hearing should be in person in the courthouse.
Yeah.
And I would never want to go away from that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I do see that we have a couple more questions, but the other judges have some information to share with us first. So we're going to get to those first, and maybe your question will be answered in their presentation. So I believe, is it Judge Conroy is next?
No, Judge Jonathan Jasper.
Oh, sorry. Judge Jasper, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairwoman Becker Finn. My name is Jonathan Jasper. I'm a judge in Anoka County in the 10th District. I've been a judge for over 15 years. As you will learn during this presentation, I am the junior Judge Jasper. My senior judge is here today as well. And with the chair's permission, I would like to just comment very briefly on one of the questions that was just asked. That is this. I haven't been in the courthouse in 11 months. I've worked from home. I've got premorbidities that makes this the best thing for me. And what I understand is they're in the process right now of putting television screens all over our courtrooms where we're going to be able to do hybrid hearings, some in person, some remotely. we've proved the concept that you can hold remote hearings and accomplish things. So, you know, the day of me having someone drive down from Duluth to make an appearance on a driving after revocation charge, I suspect is in our past, because it's just not a good, fair use of people's time. But I also want you to understand the problem with Zoom court, and I suspect you guys see some of this, is it's like a seance. I spend most of my day going, are you there? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? We can see you. Can you hear us? We can't hear you. It's surreal, and that's what makes things go so slow. But that's not what I'm here to talk to you about. I'm the chairman of the Pension and Benefits Committee of the MDJA. As such, I'm the numbers guy, if you will. The MDJA has a long history of working with the Minnesota State Retirement System, MSRS, and the legislature on pension issues. The judge's pension has been a problem to deal with because it was established in 1974, even though judges' pensions had been around since the state began. So we were founded as an unfunded pension. And that's when they started funding the pension. The problem is we had all these beneficiaries when it was started. So we began underfunded and remained that way to this day. We've worked with the legislature over and over with fits and pieces. And then in 2013, I worked closely with the legislature, and we passed a large major reform where we were in with the MSRS, in agreement with MSRS, that changed the state's contribution, increased the judge's contribution, changed the multipliers for newer judges, and did changes on the rate of return, changes on the COLA, lots of changes trying to get us more in line. As part of that, the agreement was reached with the legislature where the legislature would appropriate $6 million a year into the judge's pension to try to bring it up to a level of being fully funded, with the idea that once it's fully funded, it won't do, that won't be necessary. MSRS's calculations are right now, with the judges that are working, with the amounts being put in by the judges, the amounts being put in by the state, we are a self-funded program. But it's this $6 million a year we need to catch up from when we were an unfunded program. I'm not going to go into much more detail than that, but to let you know that the judge's pension comes up from time to time because we're trying to stay ahead of the curve. The other thing to know is we're a little itty bitty pension. So when the pension people come and talk to you, they're talking about these massive, huge, multi-billion dollar pensions, and that's not us. The next thing I'll mention is that my committee also leads the discussion on pay increase requests for judges. And what we do every biennium is we get an academic economist on a voluntary basis. We don't hire people to do a study and make recommendations as to what is the appropriate compensation for judges. We have in the last, I'm sorry, I can't go with the number, but the last about 15 years, just barely treaded water. There's been no real increase of any kind in judges' compensation. We're falling behind the private sector and even other public lawyers like county attorneys. What we will do is talk more about that when we get to you know, the bills where you guys have to decide if you're going to help support us with that. But I can tell you, for the first time in my memory, we're on board with the Judicial Council. Usually we find that they don't see things as clearly as we do. So we're fighting with them. But this year, in light of this extraordinary year that we've all been on, you'll find out that I think they're going to ask for a very modest increase. We're going to support them for that very, very modest increase. So that was really the issues and introduction I wanted to give to you, though I'm certainly happy to answer any questions. I forgot to leave. I left out, and I shouldn't, a shout out to Peggy Scott, your Republican lead, who is my representative. Hi, Peggy. So,
hi, Judge.
Now you know where I'm at.
Okay. Well, we're going to move ahead with the presentation because I don't want us to run out of time for the second presentation today. So I believe Judge Conroy is next. So if Judge, if you want to go ahead, introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your part of the presentation.
Well, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee, thank you so much for the invitation to testify here this morning. I also want to thank you for your work. I think this is a difficult time to be a public servant, and so thank you for your work and efforts on behalf of everyone who lives in the state. I have been a district court judge for the last 8 years. I ran for an open seat in an election in 2012 after serving as a prosecutor for 15 years. And after being elected to the bench, I've had a variety of my latest assignment in Hennepin County in the 4th Judicial District is on the person felony team. You might be familiar with some of the cases our team handles, might be familiar with Judge Peter Cahill and Judge Catherine Quaintance and the cases that they've been assigned. That's the team I'm currently on. I will say that my experience could not be more diverse from Judge Hoffman and Judge Jasper. I have been in the Hennepin County Government Center almost every day since June. I've had 3 jury trials in the last 4 weeks, having them go to various levels or stages of trial, including one going all the way through verdict. And so I spend a great deal of time in the courtroom, even during this pandemic. And I am, in addition to my duties in the 4th Judicial District, I am the vice president of the Minnesota District Judges Association. I'd like to describe myself as Judge Hoffman's wingman. I'm also chair of the Elections Committee, which is what I want to briefly speak with you about here this morning. Our membership on the Minnesota District Judges Association Elections Committee is very diverse. We have judges all across the state from Houston, Goodhue, Lyon, Anoka, Washington, Kandy, Ojai, Clay. We have judges all across the state. While I might live in South Minneapolis today, I grew up on a farm in southwestern Minnesota, and so I have a deep love of greater Minnesota and the need for not only diversity of age of our judges, but diversity of geography. I think we bring a different perspective, whether you're Carmen Serino from a one-judge county like Houston, or whether you're in a 63-judge county like Hennepin. And so our elections committee really represents that diversity. We also have diversity about how we come to the bench. Most judges are appointed by the governor and then sit for election within 2 years after their appointment. And then there's some of us who were elected to open seats. I want to turn now to what we saw in the latest 2020 judge elections. We had 118 judges come up for election this last fall. And in the district court races, 4 of those 118 judges faced opponents. We had 4 judges on the Court of Appeals come up for election. None of them faced a contested election. And then Supreme Court Justice Paul Thiessen was challenged by Michelle McDonald. So we had a total of 5 contested elections in 2020. We're always keeping an eye on how many contested elections we have in a given year. But our committee also keeps an eye on bills on the legislature, and we care about bills that relate to incumbency. We also keep an eye on proposals on how judges are retained. for example, our current system or proposals regarding retention elections. Now, I want to recognize that there's not enough time to dig into all of those election issues, but what I want to put out today is an invitation that should this be an area of interest for you or a bill, that we would really welcome the opportunity to have a conversation with you and to partner with you and meet when your schedules are more available. And so I will end it there and defer to Chair Becker Finn whether there are times for questions. But I just want to thank you again for all of your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Conroy. We will go to the last judge joining us this morning, and then we will go to questions. So Judge Walker Jasper, I believe you're going to talk to us a little bit more about specialty courts, which I think is a really important topic, and I'm hoping you have some good information to share with us. So please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation, and you'll have to take yourself off mute.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. I think Judge Hoffman had some more to say, but I always love to talk about specialty courts, so I'll jump in front of him any chance I get. My name is Jenny Walker Jasper. I am the senior Judge Jasper in the household. I'm the senior Judge Jasper on the fourth floor of the Anoka County Courthouse. I've been a district court judge in Anoka for over 19 years, and I do get the ability today to speak about my passion, which is really specialty courts or treatment courts. Treatment courts use extensive, comprehensive supervision, drug testing, mental health treatment services, immediate sanctions and incentives to help people make lifelong changes to keep them out of the criminal justice system. As you can see, I think there was a printout that we provided on treatment courts in the state of Minnesota. I think that was provided to the representatives today. As you can see from that printout, we have 68 operational treatment courts that cover 73 counties in the state of Minnesota. We have everything from adult drug courts, juvenile drug courts, family dependency courts, which are a court that deals with CHIPS cases, termination of parental rights cases, driving while intoxicated, DWI courts. We have mental health courts, and we have veterans treatment courts. My experience primarily is in veterans treatment courts. I will bring to your attention as well that if you look at the treatment courts that are listed here, what's really interesting is that a lot of counties looked at the possibility of having a treatment court or specialty court, and they said, you know, we've got a need, but we're too small. And you can see how the courts acted together with other counties and formed, you know, tri-county courts. I've been down to the Southwest Community Drug Court in Lincoln, Lyon, and Redwood counties and seen the good work that they do by putting three counties together to maximize resources. As I said, my experience is primarily in Veterans Treatment Court, but I also back up the Anoka Drug Court as well. The Veterans Treatment Court in Anoka County was started in 2012. And the one thing all treatment courts have in common is treatment courts, like Representative Robbins was talking about, so much of what happens in court is people come in, they meet their attorney, it's a quick appearance, they're out. A lot of times if they plead guilty, they have their appearance, they plead guilty, and they never see anybody again, or they might get a call from a probation officer saying, hey, did you get that treatment done? And that's about all the real supervision that's involved, because the caseloads are just so high, there's only so much that probation can do. treatment courts involve basically a staffing that occurs before court and then court itself. The staffing is a confidential discussion that occurs between the treatment court team, and it occurs outside of the client's presence. The client signs a form when they join the treatment court that indicates that they know that they're giving up their right to be present at that staffing where their case is going to be discussed. And at the staffing, law enforcement is there, the prosecuting attorneys there, along with sometimes their victim witness representatives, the defense attorney, a probation officer who is assigned specifically to that caseload, in this case, a veteran caseload, a VJO, and a VJO is a Veterans Justice Outreach provider who is actually employed at the VA. And they have access to all of the different types of treatment programs available and helping people to maneuver through those programs at the VA. We also have a veteran service officer who is on our court, either John Creasel, who some of you might know, he used to serve, or Tim Nelson. They come and they assist our veterans in things like helping them obtain government benefits, or helping them increase the benefits that they're eligible for, disability benefits, benefits for their children, et cetera. As I said, we have that probation officer who's assigned specifically to our court, and then we also have a mentor coordinator. So we will sit down and we will talk together about each individual client who's gonna appear in court that day. We'll talk about their progress, you know, how are they doing in chemical dependency treatment or with their mental health treatment? Are they following through with their PTSD treatment? Are they involved in treatment for military sexual trauma? What's their employment situation, or are they in school? What's their housing? Do they have a valid driver's license? If not, what do they have to do to get to that point? Where are their benefits at? Are they paying on their restitution? And we all discuss what we need to bring up in court to assist that vet in going forward. Now, we praise them when they're doing well. We give them small incentives, like perhaps a gas card. We clap for them when they hit milestones in their sobriety or completion of treatment. I should also indicate we have a nonprofit arm of our court that raises money that provides these gas cards and other benefits for our vets. If they're not doing well, we give them immediate consequences. We have them do community work service, write a paper on why it's important to make sure that you get to every one of your UAs. We give them a verbal reprimand. We can put them on an alcohol monitor, put them on electronic home monitoring, and sometimes we have to put them in jail. They move through phases in any court, whether it's veterans court, drug court, and each phase requires different milestones to be met. Days of sobriety, completion of treatment, those types of things. And as they move through treatment, or excuse me, as they move through a treatment court, they are required to come to court less. At the end, they normally receive a certificate of completion and they receive a challenge coin like vets get when they're in the military. In pre-COVID times, we would have cake, we would take pictures, they have their families come because they're literally coming to court every 2 weeks or every month for 18 months to 2 years. So a lot of times the family likes to come and see the graduation and support the vet who has gone through all of this and really changed their life. As I indicated, it takes about 18 months to 2 years to graduate from any treatment court. And at the end of graduation, the client will have had their chemical dependency or mental health issues addressed. They've established community support through churches, through AA groups, through veterans groups. they have their education or employment either going or they're in that direction. They can't graduate unless they've got housing. We can get them to have a valid DL, and most of them do have a valid driver's license. They have a mentor. They've paid their financial obligations, including restitution and fines. And so we put them in a position where going forward, they're going to be more successful.
We're running low on time and we have 5 questions.
Okay.
So I hate to cut you short, but if you could try to wrap up and then we can get to member questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll do that. I was just going to say in 2017, our court had a cost-benefit analysis that was done by the Wilder Foundation that determined that for every dollar we spent on taxpayers' money on our court, we got $1.56 back. 93% of our graduates had no criminal convictions. 86% of graduates were still chemically free. Treatment courts, because we have the time to put into people, which a lot of our courts don't, we actually end up producing people who don't come back to court, who are taxpaying, law-abiding citizens that we would like to be our neighbors. The last thing I'll leave you with is that about 2 years ago, Senators Anderson, Limmer, and Pappas actually came and sat in on our veterans court in Anoka County, and I think they got a lot out of it. So I'll leave with that, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Judge Walker Jasper. And like I said, we have at least 5 questions. So members, if you could keep your questions focused, that would be really appreciated so we can get to all of them. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Very brief question. Just the issue of cameras in the courtroom, in longstanding Minnesota tradition to have cameras in a courtroom, but now we have multiple cameras and they're all capable of being recorded. And I was just wondering if there's anything long-term that needs to be addressed in that statute. Thank you.
Yeah, whichever one of you would like to take that one.
Well, we're aware of that. We're aware that these Zoom hearings are recorded. We're not aware of misuse of that. We don't really have alternatives to prohibit it because anybody that's sitting on one of these events can record it, or they could audio record it for sure. So, I mean, we haven't noticed or heard about complaints about it or misuse of it. However, the courts are conscious of it. And if something happens, we'll have to take other steps. Hopefully what that means is we'll be back in trial courtrooms sooner than later. But I don't think that's going to happen until maybe the end of this year.
Thank you, Judge Hoffman. Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I have a question that maybe isn't as related to the things that you folks were talking about today, but I'm very concerned with equity and implicit bias. We know that when people are in stressful situations, they're more likely to rely on those biases. And that's nothing against anybody personally. That's just biology. It's what we kick back into. And so I am really thinking about, in this context with COVID-19 and these new forms of technology that we're using and these stressful situations, what preventative measures or training are judges getting to make sure that they are not relying on those implicit biases and making the best possible decisions with their judicial discretion?
Judge Hoffman.
Thank you. I can start. I know that at our last Zoom MDJA fall conference meeting, we had a presentation about that. So the trial court judges are aware of those things, and especially it was given in anticipation of having to deal in the Zoom environment for some period of time. There was a lot of attendance at, even though it was electronic meeting versus an in-person meeting, a large percentage of the trial court bench attended that. And that's what I would comment about. Maybe Judge Conroy, I don't know if you have some thoughts on that, or Judge Jasper, Walker Jasper.
Judge Conroy.
Hoffman, I can add to the question. Representative Hollins, I think that one of the issues that the bench has focused on, not just as a bench as a whole statewide, but even in the 4th Judicial District, is training. And what you have just identified is that in stressful situations, we can tend to default to instinct rather than good training. The bench in the 4th Judicial District spent our last bench retreat on issues of racial equity and what affirmative ways can we take. And it may sound minute, but everything from how we have forms completed to how we have people join us to hearings, to how we hold hearings, to how we view bench warrants, to we have really taken an aggressive look at what in our systems create an unintentional bias that we had not intended. And so I think that there's been a great commitment conference as well as in individual districts like mine to address this issue. Do I think we're there yet? No. I think we have more work to do, but I am heartened to be surrounded by colleagues that have made this a priority.
Thank you, Judge Conroy. We're going to move right along to Representative Long.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So my question is for Judge Conroy on judicial elections. I think that we've seen a number of other states that have had very, frankly, partisan judicial elections and lots of money spent on both sides. And it seems to me that we've been fortunate not to see that in our state, but I'm not sure that our laws would prevent that or that it couldn't happen in the future if there were outside interests that decided to play big in judicial elections in Minnesota. And I'm curious if there are legal changes that you all would recommend to try to get ahead of what might be a problem in the future.
Judge Conroy.
Representative Long, question. I think that from the perspective of the Minnesota District Judges Association is to leave Minnesota law as is. I believe that any type of change to how judges are either appointed or elected may create an unintended consequence of greater partisanship, greater money, and to have what's happened in other states like Wisconsin, Iowa. You look around the country and the political judicial seats are very political. We as a bench want to stay as far away from that as possible. We have a long tradition in Minnesota of keeping politics out of judicial races. And our position as the Minnesota District Judges Association is to keep current law. We don't know what changes could create some unintended consequences. I hope that's responsive to your question, Representative Long.
Thank you, Judge Conroy. Representative Frazier.
Thank you. This also goes back to Judge Conroy. I actually thought earlier when you began to talk about geography, I thought you were going to go with racial diversity. I used to practice in Hennepin County Public Defender's Office, and I recall days where I looked around the courtroom, and all the individuals that were being served looked like me. And then you look around, and you see who's the folks prosecuting, and the judge on the bench, and the clerk, and none of those folks look like me. That was over a decade ago. Diversity has only grown since then. So I can see the need to have more folks on the bench that reflect the populations that are being served, and particularly in Hennepin County and other counties as the populations and demographics are shifting. So is there any intentionality being done to focus on helping to diversify the bench?
Judge Conroy.
Yes, absolutely, Representative Frazier. We just reached parity in the 4th Judicial District of having the equal number of men and women serving on the bench. We have the most diverse bench historically in Hennepin County than we've ever had in terms of race. One of the initiatives we've engaged in the 4th Judicial District in collaboration with the Hennepin Bar Association is that judges aren't born overnight, that we need to start doing recruitment of minority law students to extern in our chambers and hire them as interns and then help mentor them through their careers. I hosted an extern 2 summers ago, and she is only in her 3rd year of law school, and she is well on her way to a really promising career. So I think we have an obligation larger in the programs that we host in order to foster that kind of diversity that we'll later on see in the bench. But I think we also need to do that in our individual relationships. And we have no doubt that when you step into a courtroom, that if you may, even if you don't see a judge of color on the bench, seeing that the clerk is a person of color, seeing that there are women who are involved in the court system, that gives the people we serve, and that includes defendants, right, a sense that maybe this is a more just and fair process.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Conroy. And last, we will go to Representative Johnson, and that will be our last question for the judges, and then we'll move on to our final presentation. So, Representative Johnson.
Chair, this question a little bit for the senior judge, Jasper. The specialty courts, veterans, drug addiction and drug courts and all those, they are fantastic. They work well. Unfortunately for me, we've looked at setting them up in my area. I'm part of the Pitt counties, Pine, Isani, Kennebec, and Chisago, which is considered the one seat. The issue that we've run across here is we have, I believe it's all 3 probation systems. We have some that do everything, some that do part, some that can't do felonies, and had bills to try to adjust that so we can actually get our specialty courts going. But because of some of the obstacles like that, it makes it hard to get them. We don't have any here. We want to get them. But because of the makeup, where the Isani County probation officers cannot do felonies by statute, it makes it difficult to get those going. So it's just something I'm still going to be working on this year, try to get that changed so we can get those specialty courts involved because they work so well. And I'm hoping I can get support from you as well.
Not sure if that was a question from Representative Johnson.
More of a comment.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And with that, we will conclude our presentation from the judges. I'm sure that all of the judges here are more than willing to answer questions. If folks think of things down the line, I'm sure that they'll be happy to answer those questions. So thank you all for joining us today. And with that, we will actually, I failed to move the minutes at the beginning of the meeting. So if I could get a motion to move the minutes from January 21st, Representative Moeller.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Moeller moves the minutes of January 21st. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the minutes are adopted. Got that taken care of. And thank you. And we will move on to the next presentation, which is from Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. I asked them to come and talk to us a little bit. Perhaps some of you have heard in some of your committee, other committees as well. There's a lot of concern about the what some are calling the eviction tsunami that may be coming whenever the eviction moratorium runs out. And so I thought it was important for us to get a better understanding of what that court process is like for folks who are going through it and the attorneys who work in that system. And so with that, we will move on to the presentation. I believe it's Ms. Dobson. If you can go ahead, introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the time to be with you today. My name is Joey Dodson. I'm a housing policy attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides civil legal services for people facing issues regarding housing, family law, immigration, public benefits, disability rights, and other civil legal matters. As part of our housing team, I've represented tenants in eviction cases, affirmative health and safety cases, housing subsidy terminations and other housing cases. I'm here today, as you said, Madam Chair, to talk about how evictions work. There are three sort of crucial chapters in the timeline when thinking about evictions. First, it's before the case is even filed. What eviction filings are avoidable? Is there work to be done to resolve more disputes without litigation? Second is once that eviction case is filed. How does the process work? For whom? And at what pace and with what resources? That's what I'll be talking about today. The final phase of the timeline is once the case is over, what is the lingering impact of an eviction filing on a family's public record and how do those parties move forward? Evictions and Minnesota landlord-tenant law in general is mostly governed by state statute, now what is now Chapter 504B. These core statutes have remained largely unchanged since 1858 when Minnesota gained statehood. Early on in our statehood, eviction cases to remove a family from their home were categorized as summary proceedings, meaning in short, a short proceeding. And eviction cases are very short. In fact, Minnesota has one of the shortest eviction court procedures in the country. The whole process can take as few as 8 days from the initial case filing to the court order telling the sheriff to remove the family from their home. I mentioned the timeline has remained mostly the same for centuries now. But since Minnesota's statehood in 1858, we've come a long way in legally acknowledging rights for renters. In 1967, we passed the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Congress passed the Fair Housing Act in 1968. In the 70s, Minnesota acknowledged tenants' rights to not be retaliated against by their landlords. In 1994, Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act, providing important protections for survivors of domestic abuse. And we've created a number of housing subsidy programs that come with their own regulations for lease requirements, terminations, and appeals. Despite these monumental changes in rights and the legal implications of the landlord-tenant relationship, the court timeline has remained summary or short. But what happens in the short timeline? First, in Minnesota, landlords are not required to give the renter any notice that there's a problem before they file a case in court. Over 40 states require some kind of notice before a court case, and we don't. So if there's a problem, the renter's behind on rent, there's a disagreement about the lease, the landlord files a court case. Now, the court case is public from the minute it's filed and serving as an eviction on the family's public record. And the renter family doesn't even necessarily know the case exists yet. The family eventually gets notice, gets served. Statute requires that the case be served 7 days before the court hearing. So the family comes to court. You heard from the judge guest earlier today about specialty housing courts. The second and fourth judicial districts in Hennepin and Ramsey have specialty housing courts. So normal times, without the virtual hearings and social distancing practices that we've heard about from our judges today, typically housing court is packed, stressful, it's a confusing place. Housing court in Hennepin is on the third floor. About 45 cases are heard in an afternoon. So that means that this short hallway is crammed with upwards of 100 people, parents, kids. A disproportionate number of eviction filings or defendants are single mothers of kids. There's a handful of lawyers and clerks answering questions. When it's time for the calendar, the crowd packs into a small courtroom where the roll is called. When your case is called, you find your landlord or the lawyer there to represent them, and you go back out in the hallway to talk about your case. The court typically orders parties to try to reach a settlement agreement. You're elbow to elbow with the next family right next to you, doing calculations in your head about when you can make rent, making quick decisions about where your family's gonna sleep that night or maybe the next week. It's stressful, and you're urged to sign on the dotted line just to get things over with. You may or may not have the chance to talk to your own lawyer and to learn about your rights. Once you reach an agreement or realize you won't be reaching one, you go back into the courtroom to update the court. Of course, as you heard today about virtual hearings with Zoom, this looks a little bit different these days. But really, representing tenants in eviction cases is quite similar to public defense work in the criminal context. Current law presumes that a full-blown trial will happen at that very first court appearance. and the court only has the power by statute to stay or continue that trial for up to 6 days. That means if your first court appearance is on a Monday, that means your trial is no later than that Friday. And this has been the law since 1858. And I think it's important to just think about that. You know, 6 calendar days is hardly enough time to find a babysitter, you know, and arrange for transportation to court. Certainly not enough time to find a lawyer versed in fair housing, state statute, federal housing subsidy regulations, prepare a defense, gather evidence, and prepare for trial. Most civil trials take months, if not years. But in Minnesota, we say you should be ready to stand trial for your home in less than a week. Most cases don't go to trial. Most cases settle. They reach an agreement usually for the tenant to pay back owed rent or to move out by a certain date. But based on the cases that Legal Aid sees here, about 70% of renters facing eviction have some legal defense to their case. What they don't have is the time and resources to litigate and prove that defense in a court. I work with a team of about 20 housing lawyers. We represent tenants facing eviction in Hennepin County. Before COVID struck, we had the capacity to represent about 10% of families facing eviction in Hennepin County Housing Court. For those we represent at Legal Aid, we win or reach positive settlement agreements 96% of the time. Without an attorney, that percent is considerably lower. It goes to show the difference that having the time and legal resources to thoroughly analyze a case and reach a fair result can make. So just briefly, I'll touch on the impact of an eviction case. As I mentioned, the second a case is filed, it appears on a person's record as an eviction, regardless of what happens to that case. Today, getting evicted or having an allegation filed against you in court is a life-altering event. An eviction filing today has even more impact than it used to, due to the accessibility of public data online and the scarcity of safe, affordable housing. And evictions, they're not just a symptom of generations of oppression. They're a cause of inequality to come. An eviction filing today forces renters into unsafe, unstable, unhealthy housing down the road. We know that kids in unhealthy housing situations suffer worse health outcomes, worse educational outcomes, and are more likely to be evicted themselves when they grow up. So one eviction is upstream from another, upstream from potentially an unsafe housing situation, lead paint, mold, bed bugs. We support proposals to prevent evictions and to make them more fair. Evictions disproportionately impact Black, Indigenous, and people of color, parents and kids. We saddle them with eviction records and force them into living in these difficult, unsafe situations. And as you brought up, Madam Chair, what do we predict is coming now after the moratorium and various moratoria are lifted? The U.S. Census Bureau estimates that there are 80,000 Minnesota households potentially facing eviction due to being behind on rent right now. In a typical year, about 15 to 17,000 eviction cases would be filed in a year in Minnesota. That means that if the moratorium on most cases was lifted tomorrow, the courts could be overloaded with 4 to 5 times the number of cases they typically handle in a whole year. And this is just about the system and how it is and how the law mandates that judges and judicial officers handle these cases. It's not about landlords doing anything wrong or tenants doing anything wrong. This is just the process that we have set up as a society. Again, thank you, Madam Chair, so much for the opportunity to be with you all today and members of the committee. I'm happy to answer any questions about the eviction process that you may have. My colleague, Ron Elwood, from the Legal Services Advocacy Project is also present and available for questions as well. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Dobson. And we do have questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to clarify a few things. The testifier's characterization of the eviction process that I've experienced as a landlord is nothing like what she just described. that was a huge commentary on what her thoughts are. It's not, in my experience, what actually happened. And I've been to Hennepin County eviction processes. I've been to Anoka County eviction processes. And it's nothing like what she described. And to characterize eviction process as an 8-day process and say that these tenants had no knowledge of prior to that, that something was going to happen. I mean, maybe there are landlords out there that are like that, but we do everything we can to keep our tenants in their housing. Turning over a unit is expensive for us, and we don't want to put people out on the streets. Believe it or not, landlords don't want to do that. So what I've experienced is you work with the tenant, you give them warning after warning, plus in their lease, it tells them exactly what the process will be. If your rent is not here by the 10th of the month, or the 12th of the month, then, you know, there's a likelihood that an eviction process will begin. But that doesn't mean that that's what's going to automatically happen. We work with the people to try to get them to pay. And if we're getting nowhere, then we follow through with the eviction process. It's expensive to file an eviction. We know we're probably never going to get that money back. It's $300-$400 just to file the eviction process and have the papers served by a sheriff. So you file the eviction papers. It's usually 2 weeks before you can even get in to get a court date. So there's 2 more weeks that you have to work with the tenant for the tenant to maybe they get emergency assistance to pay for their rent. Maybe they had a car breakdown. We're sympathetic to that. We set them up on payment plans. So then you have the court appearance. Again, there's another opportunity to work with them during the court appearance. As the testifier did say, you go out in the hallway, you talk to them. If they're represented, you speak with them. We usually didn't have a lawyer representing us. We went in on our own and tried to work with the people again. Then if there are no show or if a situation just can't be worked out, then the summary judgment, I believe it's called, is filed. And then they have the judge determines in the court process when that person should have to leave the property and be moved out. So I understand that we've had this moratorium. I've been in contact with the Multi-Housing Association. 85% of people, even during this COVID period, are paying their rent. So I don't know that we're going to have a huge flood. There may be somewhat of a flood, but I don't think we're going to have this huge flood of folks filing evictions. And so I just wanted to present my experience as a landlord, and we've been a landlord for 25 years. And so I just felt that the presenter was very biased and did not present a fair view of what I've experienced. So thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me explain that, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Scott, for sharing that story of what it's like for one landlord. I think you know, there can be multiple versions of the reality for different people from different sides of the process. And Ms. Dobson, if you want to respond, you can go ahead, but go ahead, Ms. Dobson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. And I certainly appreciate that many landlords work with their tenants and go above and beyond to reach positive outcomes. You know, we appreciate the Multi-Housing Association, and we talk on a regular basis about options. Unfortunately, many of the clients that I serve and that Legal Aid serves, they rent from folks who aren't members of the Multi-Housing Association. They work with landlords who perhaps aren't as responsible of housing providers as you are and many landlords are. So I'm just sharing the perspective of those clients that we serve. So thank you, Madam Chair and Representative.
Yeah, thanks, Ms. Dobson. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is, I do think we may see this flood of cases coming through the courts for evictions that are going to be sent up. And the question I have for the courts is, if they're all still here, do we have a plan for that? That's the first question I have.
Madam Chair. Yeah. Judge Hoffman, go ahead.
I was going to give a presentation about evictions from Anoka, and I knew we ran out of time. But let me give you some statistics, okay? The statistics are that at the state level, evictions on a monthly basis from March of 19 were about 1,600, 1,500 a month. That's statewide. As of November of 2020, they dropped to 145 a month. Now, that's statewide. In our district, in the 10th, they went from 2019, these are cases a year, they went from 2,215 cases in all of the eight counties in our district down in 2020, 688. So the evidence is from this data that we have from the Judicial Council is that 81% of all public eviction cases filed during these moratoriums have been handled by the courts, and 94% of those cases have proceeded with either a hearing or a judgment or resolution. But what we don't know about those numbers is, what happened to all those cases that would have not been filed? And we don't know. But we are anticipating, at least in the 10th, that that's going to be a bunch of cases. And so we have a plan within our district in the 10th to have a troubleshooting team of senior judges, assigned court staff, hired law clerks under pandemic CARES Act in funding to deal with this the minute it happens. And they will be district-wide hearings of trial senior trial court judges that will triage these cases in our district. So we will have a triage tree with the staff that have been assigned to the judge to determine if the case has been properly filed, if it has been timely filed. And then we will have an initial hearing to find out, to put resources like Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid together with public defenders and probably volunteer attorneys in our district to see if we can triage out cases that can be resolved. And then only those cases that are left will be the ones actually set for trial. But the group that we're going to work with are going to try to resolve cases rather than just say to try them, because we don't know if we can try 800 or 900 cases or 1,000 cases that come into our courts, but we're going to do it on a uniform basis in the 10th. And I know the Judicial Council is talking about this also to deal with the pandemic backlog about eviction cases. I'm simply talking about the 10th district here.
Thank you, Judge Hoffman. Follow up, Representative Frazier.
Yeah, I'll save my question, but I'll say, Judge Hoffman, thank you for that. I'm glad you all in intent for being proactive and that you have a plan in place. And I hope that the you said the Judicial Council is looking at this well. I hope that other districts also have a plan in place as well.
Madam Chairman, and I might say,
Judge Hoffman,
we do not have a specialty court like Hennepin and Ramsey with just landlord-tenant cases, but my guess is Hennepin and Ramsey are going to be doing the same thing we're doing in the 10th, because they probably, of the metro area, have the greatest amount of landlord-tenant potential exposure in those two courthouses.
All right. Thank you, Judge Hoffman. We've got four questions, so we're going to keep to these four. You each get about 2.5 minutes. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dobson, I'm wondering for the governor's executive order on evictions, what we've seen from the landlord side in terms of adhering to the narrow exceptions for when landlords can evict. Are we seeing landlords follow those closely, or are we seeing any abuse in that area?
Ms. Dobson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Long, for that question. And so the moratorium as it exists, we talk about evictions being on pause, and that's true for most cases. But as you identified, there are a number of exceptions that largely legal aid clients, these exceptions are a chasm that legal aid clients often fall into, in part because of the nature of the exceptions, allegations of public safety, allegations of criminal activity that we know those allegations fall disproportionately on people of color, not necessarily because the allegations are true. We have seen, and legal aid in Hennepin County has been able to represent every tenant who has come to an eviction court hearing and express their desire to have an attorney. So even though the narrative is that evictions are on pause, and that's true for most cases, our lawyers are in court every day of the week representing on the evictions that are filed. And as I said, there are legal defenses to those cases. We have seen, and the Attorney General's actually just filed an amicus brief in one of Legal Aid's cases regarding the state of the moratorium, which I'd be happy to follow up with you afterward, explaining from the Attorney General's perspective what they're hearing. And included in that amicus brief is a discussion of landlords who are communicating with the Attorney General's office, indicating that they, in fact, will resort to self-help or illegal lockouts that aren't permissible under Minnesota law. So we are the ones who are seeing, I think, the situations where cases are being mischaracterized to smush into these exceptions. So we are seeing that, and I would refer you to that brief that I'd be happy to circulate after this hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Dobson. If you could, we might already have, staff might already have it, but thank you for that. Next, we'll go to Representative Johnson, and then we've got Vang and Novotny, and we will wrap up. So Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Chair Beckerfin, I was disappointed in the mischaracterization that Ms. Dobson did and how the system works. I have yet to hear in my entire lifetime of serving evictions notice one going 8 days. In my area, the way the eviction process works, before you can even file an eviction, the landlord has to provide a written notice to the tenant that it's going to start the process, giving them time to make up or correct the issue. Then it's filed. Law enforcement serves the paper, which gives them, usually it's a 2 week ahead of time before the court trial. If they go to court and the judge finds in favor of the landlord, the person has 30 days to remove themselves from the property. If they don't move, the landlord has to, again, file the paperwork, pay the charges. Sheriff's office has to serve the papers. A court date usually happens 2 weeks later, and the judge gives them 2 weeks to move out. If they still don't move up, the same process starts again. The landlord might have $1,000 in expenses. And we're now at 3 months since the 3-4 months since the initial. Again, the person has time to move out. If they don't, one more round of it, where then at that point the law enforcement actually goes in and physically removes the person. That's 6 to 9 months from the initial sending a letter that the landlord's is looking at an eviction process if they don't take care of the issue. I would like to know what the special circumstances were that one happened in 8 days, because that's not how it works. The only way it would be an 8-day eviction if it was a restraining order issue where the person was physically removed because of a restraining order. Thank you.
So first, I just want to say, you know, we all have our own personal experiences and backgrounds, and I think it's important for all of us to sort of be careful to recognize that our experience might not be the experience of someone else. So I don't think it's fair to mischaracterize anybody, you know, whether it's somebody on this committee or a testifier of somehow willfully being untruthful in what their experience has been in the system. There certainly is room for different experiences. Ms. Dobson, if you have a response to Representative Johnson's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the question, Representative Johnson, just very briefly, There are, as I mentioned before, there are certainly landlords who have practices of giving notice before eviction filings. That practice is not required by law, and there are plenty of landlords who don't provide that notice on their own accord. And we could talk maybe at a later date about sort of the timelines of the eviction, of what the laws provide for in the eviction process. But I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Ms. Dobson. Representative Vang and Representative Novotny, if we can stay focused, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a statement. I do want to uplift Ms. Dobson's testimony. I just want to say that two truths can exist in a reality. In my other day job, I'm a tenant advocate, and the experience that Ms. Dobson is talking about is true for many of the tenants that I work with. And I will also say that at my other day job, we also train landlords to know the law, because a lot of the times when tenants come to us having these issues, a lot of the times the landlords are not following the law. And at the same time, renters aren't aware of their rights. And so that's where the problems exist. And so I know when we see that landlords are rational and they know the legal rights and the law, a lot of the problems subside, and a lot of issues are handled, are managed. And so the reason why we're talking about these is the eviction issues is because a lot of the times renters aren't aware of the rights, and landlords are not following the legal steps to ensure that everyone's rights are protected. And so that's just what I want to highlight, and I want to thank Ms. Dobson for your testimony. And this is a very, very issue, and provide a little bit more context about why we're hearing more of these issues, rather than and why we are not hearing more of the issues, the part where landlords are actually following through the law and working with tenants and doing their due diligence. So that's just all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vang. And finally, Representative Novotny. You get the closing question.
Thank you, Chair. For Judge Hoffman, just do you see a related increase in foreclosures that is also going to be hitting the courts, and how will that affect the court's schedule and the pending logjam?
I don't.
Judge Hoffman.
Oh, sorry, Madam Chair. I don't see that yet. You know, we went through a period of time when I was first here in Washington that we went through a slew of foreclosures when the economy went down in 8 and 9 and 10. I don't see that here. In fact, you know, most of our judges have assigned civil, criminal, juvenile, family. And I cannot tell you in the last 2 years that I've had an assigned foreclosure matter in Washington County. So it's not happening yet. There are people that have been impacted differently by this economy blowing up. And it's just not clear to me. It's a good question you're asking, but I do not see evidence of it, at least here in Washington. And, you know, maybe Judge Conroy knows something about what's going on in Hennepin better than I do.
And actually, we don't have time to get into a full discussion, but we can certainly, if there's follow-up, I'm sure we can get some additional answers. I do want to say I thank our presenters today, and especially Ms. Dobson. I think especially, you know, many people on this committee also serve on Ways and Means or have served on the Select Committee on Racial Justice. And I think an important piece of that is the discussion about wealth disparities and how that impacts housing and how that is a long-term systemic issue. And so that was one of the reasons I wanted to highlight the eviction court process and what we may be able to do to address some of those inequities and make things better moving forward. So at least the system itself, the court system itself, and the pieces there are fair for everybody. And so thank you all very much for your words and for presenting today. We do on Thursday, we'll actually have a couple bills coming up. Representative Moeller is ready to go with a couple bills. So will be doing that on Thursday, as well as a presentation from the tax courts. So again, thank you everybody for being on time and your good questions, and we will see you on Thursday. With that, we are adjourned.